Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
Hey, good morning. Doug Cenceri, Michelle Demmer, Cenceri, all things legal. Gives call 260-1870. And I have here my wife and law partner, attorney, who responded to my elbow this morning at about... No, I'll respond to your elbow.
Yeah, I got up first.
You get up early.
I did get up early. I took care of all these dogs in this house. And
yeah, we're about to put a call out to our neighborhood because we have two dogs, Jeffy and Jazzy.
Right.
And Jeffy makes a great escape every day.
Every day. Sometimes he goes up to the church.
Right. And so he goes through the neighborhood. He wants to, we suspect he wants to convert to Presbyterian because he always ends up at the Presbyterian church.
He does. We get a call a lot.
On Sundays.
He's up there.
So what's the name of the church?
Yeah, New Covenant, maybe?
New Covenant, maybe?
I think so.
We want to thank you, the people at New Covenant, for taking care of our dog. And it's okay if he converts. Just throw some holy water on him or do whatever you got to do, and he's there. You know. But.
The excitement of the morning.
Excitement of the morning in God's country in Mandeville, in downtown Mandeville. Downtown Mandeville, where we now do social distancing.
Where we do, yeah.
We social distance from the WWL studio.
That's
now.
Right.
So we're in compliance with Governor Edwards' mandates and laws. So thank goodness.
Thank goodness.
We won't have any agents.
He won't close us down.
So we're in the throes of August.
We are.
And we start usually talking about sports. We got a little to talk about today.
Yeah.
Yeah. August 2nd, 1967.
I know the answer.
I know. We talked about it last night. What happened on August 2nd, 1967?
It's the first time the Saints played the preseason game.
First preseason game against
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles Rams. Now,
see, I do listen.
Now, for your premillennials and your students and recent graduates who don't take the bar exam, that gave me just material for the next 2 years. The Saints started in 1967. They used to play 6 preseason games instead of 4. Now they play 0. This year, they're not playing any. And they played the Los Angeles Rams at Anaheim Stadium. And they lost 16-7.
Right.
Jimmy Taylor was the starting running back, the great Jimmy Taylor, who just passed a couple of years ago. Played for the Green Bay Packers, won, I think, 5 NFL championships. Then from LSU.
So he didn't play for the Saints for very long.
No, he played 1 year.
Yeah.
I think he had 371 yards his only year. And then, you know who was on the sideline? But never played, but was on the team. He was supposed to be the other running back.
I have no idea.
Paul Hornung, the great Paul Hornung.
Oh.
But he never played a down. So they lost 16-7. Bill Becknell, my former boss, was at the game. And if Bill is listening, please call, because I'd like to have a firsthand account
of the game,
of the first Saints preseason game, August 2nd, 1962.
Exciting. Weren't you listening to something last night? And then I heard, and it was 20 years before they had a winning season.
Yes, that was it. I was doing my research on this fact. Now, another thing for you social justice warriors.
Lord, what?
Huh? Everyone stood for the national anthem, and there were no masks during that game.
There you go.
Just in case you were wondering, you know.
And they could have never foretold what would happen all those years later.
Yeah, so. So the Saints were, that's what they had. That's when was their birth. They were, here's another interesting fact.
Who owned them then?
Huh?
Who owned them then?
John Meikle.
He did. That's what I thought.
He bought them for, he acquired the team on November 1st, 1966 for $7 million.
Who did he acquire them from?
The NFL. There's a great story how the Saints became in existence. In 1964, they had the AFL. They were going to bring the Saints down. They played the AFL All-Star Game, 1964, Tulane Stadium. And they were about to award an expansion team to New Orleans, and they wouldn't do it because of segregation. They said, we're not going to award a team to a city that had segregation. So they didn't get it. And then sort of got their act together a little bit. And then it was politics. Imagine that. Hale Boggs, great Hale Boggs, was on the Appropriations Committee. And the deal was this. The NFL is a monopoly. Yep. What other business can you say, I graduate from college, you have to play at this city?
Right.
Or you can't play. What other industry do they have that? You don't do that for accountants.
No.
If you graduate as an accountant at LSU, they don't tell you, don't get drafted by Denver and say you have to work as a CPA in Denver for 4 years before you can go work somewhere else.
But I think it's the only way that the business works. Can work.
It's competitive balance. In fact, when we went to the Supreme Court, that's what the justice said.
Right.
They said, well, it's different because it's football. But anyway, you had – so Hale Boggs and a couple other politicians wanted a team in New Orleans. And so they said – they were lobbying the team, Pete Rozelle at the time, and wasn't getting much of a response. And then they say, you know what, that antitrust exemption we have in Congress, I think we're going to take a look at that. That's a true story.
Really?
And they were, because if you lift the antitrust exemption, the NFL gets blown up.
Right.
It just becomes something different. And all of a sudden, Pete Rozelle says, you know what? I think that's a good idea for the New Orleans to have a team. And they were awarded a team. And November 1st, 1966, All Saints Day, they were purchased for $7 million. And John Meekum, my boss's boss.
Did they put it up for, like, bid, or did they
they were looking – basically, they did an internal process to see who could come up with the money. At the time, John Meekum Sr. would probably be akin to – who's the guy? J.R. Ewing on Dallas?
Mm-hmm.
Probably a character like that. And he died in 1981, but he had a son, John Jr., who's 27 and looking for a job. He said, well, let me just give you the Saints. And he and it was sort of history from there. But he was younger than most of the players.
Wow.
He was 27 years old on the sideline. And he was, you know, big guy, good-looking guy. You know, just he fit the part.
Wow. Interesting story.
Yeah, so the Saints, so I think Hale Boggs and I don't know who else was in Congress at the time, threatened to remove the antitrust exemption. Hence, all of a sudden, Pete Rozelle got an epiphany. Is that what you say, epiphany?
Mm-hmm. Epiphany.
Epiphany, and said, no, we got to have the Saints. So, and then, since they were on All Saints Day, they were awarded. They said, well, we're
just naming the Saints.
Saints, they were Catholic, and they ran it by Archbishop Hannon. He said, well, he said, basically, I'm not quoting him directly, he said, well, I'm okay, it's not sacrilegious, but they're going to need a lot of prayers. It's a true story.
Yeah.
So he did say that. So the Saints were their first game, 16-7. They lost to the Rams. And
when I was growing up, my great aunts was a nun, and so all of her nuns were always at my grandfather's house, and they were all big Saints fans. So I just figured it was just a big religious thing.
Well,
I didn't know much about football then.
Like 99% of the people who grew up Catholic in New Orleans, like myself, what we used to do, and I told you this before, I don't know if I told the audience this, we needed to get to Tulane Stadium on time because parking was an issue. You had to park in neighborhoods and that sort of thing. So what we did was we were in St. Angelo Parish, which is in Metairie, near Bonneville and Veterans. We would drive over to St. Pius Parish, where they had Father Screen, and he would do a 25-minute mass.
Before the game?
Before, so that everybody could get on time to Tulane Stadium. So we would drive across town to go to a mass so we could get to the game on time at Saints. They'd either play at 12 or 1 o'clock. And so it was like Father Screen was like, you know, he's going through the thing, and he gets to the homily. He says, love other people. It's over. Then he goes to the next part. And then we're out of there in 25 minutes. He's heading to the game.
You got your check off.
Got the check off, and we're sanctified and we're ready to go. So there you go.
That was funny. Some
Saints history there. So it's weird. I'm not hearing a lot about Saints training camp because – how do you practice social distancing?
I have no idea. It's going to be very interesting.
Feels like those rookies are going to have a hard time
making
the team. They don't have any games to.
I know. It'll be a new way to do it.
And also, while we're on this, the Pelicans, they're struggling. Now, I'm glad Albert's not here today. he would be going bananas right now because the Pelicans had a 16-point lead against the New Orleans, the Utah Jazz, who used to be the New Orleans Jazz
right.
for you pre-millennials and also you law students who don't need to take the bar. Is they used to have a team before with the New Orleans Jazz, which now moved to Utah. And when they moved to Utah, they didn't have the wisdom to change their name from the Jazz to the, you know, I don't know, the
Snow
Bears or something. You know, I don't know, what do you call those? Snow Bears?
Polar Bears?
Polar Bears.
Oh, yeah,
something
polar
like
bears
that.
In Utah.
They didn't, I don't know, what the, you know, ice caps or something. But they did, so that's why they called the Jazz, because they started out in New Orleans. So they played them, 16-point lead, and they lost it. And I know
is
what
Zion
Albert,
playing?
Huh?
Is Zion playing?
Yeah, his minutes were limited.
Why? Because of his injury still?
Well, he came back out of quarantine, and yeah, the doctors were worried about him. He's fragile, because he's so big.
Yeah.
And so they limited his minutes. He only played 15 minutes and only scored 13 points, I think. But Albert would be like going bananas because he's not an Alvin Gentry fan. His coach.
Yeah, no, he's not
say,
at all. I know that.
Him and Les Miles are in the same little bucket with him. So they lost it, and then they lost last night to the Clippers. That game was it was not only unwatchable, it was not even worth checking on your phone for scoring updates because they were beating us so bad.
What were you watching the other night when we were watching
us? That's
the
Utah Jazz.
Okay.
That's what they were up 16, and all of a sudden they're down.
Yeah.
I'm like, what's happening here?
Are there no fans there? They're just playing to an empty?
What is cardboard fans?
Are you serious?
Yeah, they put cardboard fans up there, and they make you look like fans.
And that's supposed to help the players?
Well.
And then they pipe in?
I don't know. I don't know if they're piping in fans. They do that in Major League Baseball. I know, that's crazy. And LSU had his tickets policy. If it seems like if you're going to be in phase two, LSU will be at 50% capacity.
So what are they going to call 50% of us and say you can't come this
week?
Yes,
exactly. Well, season ticket, they're going to do a priority. And then if they're phase three, 75%. And I think you have to wear – I don't know if you have to wear a mask or not. I'd like to see –
What if you have – like we have four seats. What if you have 10 seats and only they say and they divide it by rows?
That's Scott Woodard's problem, the AD.
Dang.
I'd like to see them try to drink tailgate with their mask on. All right. We're going to talk about the mask lawsuit after the break. But let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri, All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri, All Things Legal. Let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to our man, Justin. Hey, Justin, you're in All Things Legal. What you got for us?
Can y'all hear me okay?
Yeah, we
yeah,
hear
we
you,
hear
Justin.
You.
Loud and
hey,
clear.
Hey, good morning, Michelle and Doug. How y'all
good
doing?
Good morning.
We're doing great.
We're great.
We're doing
How
great.
Are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. I do have a legitimate law question, but I'm going to preface this by saying I love to drop my dad's name, Jack Marcel. When I was growing up, he was a big Saints fan like I was. And the first 20 years, they were so bad, he would be so infuriated, I couldn't even talk to the guy. So he would say, we're going back to Notre Dame firing the Irish football. That's where we're going. That's where he graduated.
Now, do you remember watching Notre Dame highlights at 10:30 in the morning before there was ESPN? Lindsey Nelson.
Oh, absolutely.
And,
yes, sir, I do.
And sure. Paul Hornung. Because that was the only highlights that they had on, and then they had the Charlie Mack show on after. And,
Charlie Mack. Boy, that's a name I haven't heard in a long time, Doug.
That's wow. It. So that's – I grew up a Notre Dame fan, you know, Theismann for Heisman.
Let me tell you one quick thing before I get to the law question. My dad really pressured me to go to Notre Dame because he wanted to have a legacy. I said, Dad, I'll never make it to Notre Dame. Forget it. So
it's
I didn't
too
know.
It's too cold. It's too cold.
It's a beautiful campus, though. It's a beautiful,
yeah, it beautiful.
Campus. God, it's beautiful. Anyway, let me get to my law question.
Okay.
I'm not gonna try this, but for a beneficiary of a trust, is it possible legally to dissolve it and I can take the money and run?
Generally not. The only time... usually a trust is for a specific period of time or they'll have certain conditions upon ending.
Or now, until the money runs out.
Or until the money runs out. Yes, that's it's no use having a trust if you have no money in it, that's for sure.
Right.
Now some trusts, like the trust we do, Michelle, is the ones we have where a lot of them we say that the trustee has the discretion to terminate the trust if situation, you know, certain circumstances warranted, or maybe totally discretionary. But that's, it's you know, a trust is basically governed between the four corners of the document. That's why we will spend a little time on trust, because you have to ask a lot of what if questions.
Right. You're right, right.
You know, what if the beneficiary passes? What if the beneficiary comes incapacitated? What if the trustee is no longer to serve as the trustee? You know, what, you know, if the beneficiary doesn't have children, where does his money go? You know, those type of things. And
okay, so
especially on an irrevocable trust,
right,
which is can't be revoked. And you know,
I don't know that part of it. I don't know that part of it.
Well, like,
I do
this,
know. I do. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
You go ahead. You go ahead, Justin.
All right. Well, I know I'm the beneficiary, which means the trust pretty much is out of my hand. I'm at their beck and call, and you're telling me that they could just turn the trustee could turn around and just take the trust away from me?
No.
Not take it away. To dissolve it.
If it's
financially better to dissolve the trust, if there's not enough money in it, or if the trustee feels like maybe it was to end upon the beneficiary turning the age of 40 of certain conditions, and then maybe that beneficiary meets those conditions at the age of 38, then the trustee has discretion. No, they cannot take it away.
I'll put to you this way. If they have strong enough language, even Vito Corleone could not even dissolve a trust.
Right.
His influence could not.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to attempt it. The reason I ask this question is because I've told you before, having a trust is both a blessing and a curse. And sometimes during these past years, it's been a curse. I just say I want to get out of it. But it's such a blessing, I can't get rid of it. So
I
don't want to dissolve it. But you say it's practically impossible to do something like that.
Well, if you have a trust that says it's to extend a certain period of time and there's no discretionary termination, it's going to extend to that period of time. Now, you are owed a duty of accounting, you know, so that, you know, the trustee owes you an accounting.
They account
everything they do.
I think for me, the only right a beneficiary would have is be to challenge whether the fiduciary duty of the trustee was adhered to, and then get the trustee changed, but not really terminating the trust.
You can't terminate the trust. If the trustee's not following the terms and conditions of the trust, then you can sort of take the trustee to task, you know, legally.
Well, Michelle and Doug, I just need an excuse to call and say hello. That's all.
Justin, we always like hearing from you.
Go Irish there. Go Tigers.
Go Irish, yeah, baby. Have a great day.
Go Irish.
Thanks, Justin.
All right, Jay. All right, let's go to the official retired NOPD blue police officer, Jay, our favorite. You're the official retired NOPD. And you know what, Jay? We love our blue here, so you're welcome. We will be courteous to you. We will not, you know, spit on you or anything like that.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
We can hear you.
Okay. First off, I want to say Michelle sounds so much younger than you, Doug.
I mean, Jay, you're my best
I don't know
friend.
What happened there, okay?
Michelle, you might have been able to do better. I hit the lottery.
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
I think I did pretty well.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
You could go on Facebook and stream, you see, and you could see.
I can't because I'm computer illiterate, but I've had friends say nice compliments, not about you, about Michelle.
Oh, yeah. She's hot.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, stop it.
But I wanted to tell you, Doug, about Saints. I was at the first game when Gilliam in the south end zone. You weren't born yet, huh?
I was 5 years old.
Okay. I'm 64, so. And south end zone, $1 a ticket for me with my dad, you know. And you could bring in ice chests, picnic baskets, you name it, right?
They had the beer vendor, which is formerly known as Dixie,
what's it called now, Yankee?
No, I don't know.
Yeah, we don't have to get into that.
But he had like a space pack on his back. Do you remember that? And he would pour the beer, a small keg on his back, and he would pour the beer in. And you know,
I wasn't drinking beer. I was 10.
Well, I was 12 years old when Tulane Stadium the last game, so I had a few, I think, maybe. But
No, the south end zone.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the south end zone had the student tickets for $1, $1.50.
$1 under 18. We went to the first Super Bowl, my dad and I, and it was Kansas City and who? Minnesota, right?
Minnesota, Joe Kapp and Lynn Dawson.
Right. You know how much the tickets were?
$10.
$15. And my father said, I can't believe I'm paying $15 for a ticket. I don't mean to bore Michelle and the rest
of you. Are you not boring me?
I got to tell you this one story. Because, you know, they had season tickets, so you'd always be around the same people. My dad got them for about 6 years and that. And they had this most annoying kid. Maybe he thought I was, but I really was a well-behaved young man. But this kid was just annoying. And you know they let the doves fly out? Yeah. Remember that?
They had the doves. They had the spaceman who used to fly out in and out. Remember
the
that?
The doves, I swear, Doug, on my daughter's head. The dogs must have said, "Dad's that annoying kid," and
they let go.
I swear, out of 80,000 people, this kid got dropped. Okay, it was—I mean, it wasn't funny, sort of. But
well, the CIA ought to hire that dove because he seems very targeted.
That's right.
I didn't have anything legal to. I just wanted to touch base with y'all.
Was that the end zone where John Gillum threw the ball after he scored a touchdown, or were you in the other end zone? Because the one had an upper deck and one.
No, I think he ran. The south end zone was the open end zone.
The open end zone. Okay, I remember that one. So he caught. I think he caught it in that end zone and ran
to the north end zone. And I was there for the Dempsey kick too. I was. You know, kid, then.
That's it.
Hey, let me ask you something. Yes. You got a sec? 1 second?
Yeah. I got plenty of time.
I know you're a history buff.
Yes.
Okay? Just finished a book on John Dillinger. Okay?
Yes.
How much you think him and his guys stole in 13, 14 months?
I have no idea.
$2 million? How much?
Huh?
$2 million?
Well, in today's world, it'd be $3.5 million. It was $330,000.
Okay,
can you imagine that?
Dang.
Well, yeah, he was. Where did he work? He was in Chicago. Where did he work out of?
Chicago, the Midwest. And it's a good book. Check out Public Enemies on now. It's the movies. Public Enemies on Netflix and that. But I know you're a history buff. I am too, you know.
Yeah, well, you spent a career chasing down Dillinger's, huh?
No, I wouldn't say that.
You wouldn't say that.
All right, good seeing
thanks
y'all.
For calling.
All right,
thanks.
That's the official NOPD retired for the show. He's Jay.
He's
yes,
a nice
what
guy.
Are you going
to
say?
How much time do we have?
We've got about 20 seconds before we go to break. You want to wait till it?
I'll wait.
All right, let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri, all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief time out. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri, all things legal. And any opinions given about the Saints are fact and truth by me. You were talking about you went to Tulane Stadium.
Yeah, we had tickets with the neighbors across the street. I think I was in third grade.
Yeah.
And so the older girl, my friend, was in fourth grade. So she was the oldest, and we would go with the parents. We parked at their grandparents' house on Maple. I think it was Maple. It was uptown.
Yeah,
we could walk to the stadium. The kids walked together. The parents walked separately. And,
Did you have a cell phone then?
No, we didn't even have a quarter. We had, like, hot chocolate and a blanket if it was cold. And, yeah. And so
see you back after the game.
Yeah, see you after the game. Make sure you get back here on time. No parental supervision, nothing. I mean, that would never happen these days.
Yeah.
It was just, especially in the city, but just interesting how the times have changed.
We're our seats were UH.
I knew
row
you would
one,
remember.
Section 1, 2, 3, and 4. 20 yard line, upper deck.
I think we were on the upper deck because I remember being cold and I remember being much cheaper seats than the
I remember when the Redskins were playing the Saints and I'm looking at my binoculars and I see Vince Lombardi, who coaches only a year at Redskins. I'm like, I thought I just saw a divine figure.
Yeah, I just had it all.
I just looked in the binoculars. Says that's a divine figure there, and he was gone the next year.
That's funny.
You know, we'll talk a little law. This is interesting.
Perfect.
A little update. There's been another lawsuit that was filed over the mask mandate, and we're sort of just keeping
everybody informed.
Informed to that, they had 11 bar owners, and who filed a federal lawsuit Wednesday against John Bell Edwards and also Marshall Butch Browning, the enforcement officer for virus regulations for Governor Edwards, stating that the...
Is it filed in the Middle District?
It's the Middle District, in Lafayette. Yeah. On behalf of 11 bars in the Lafayette area, including Acadia, New Iberia, Morgan City, Youngsville, and Lafayette, saying that the mask mandate is illegal, which shares the opinion of Attorney General Jeff Landry.
Yeah. Did you read his letter to the governor?
Yeah,
it was really
It was very thoughtful.
It was thoughtful.
And he said, and the bar owners argue that Governor Edwards cannot show a real or substantial relation between the closure of the bars to on-site drinking and public health crisis. And so, recent graduates of law school.
I knew it was coming.
Who's not taking the bar, you might want to listen to this because you need all the help you can get. They say it is argued that only a small number of known COVID-19 cases have been traced to bars by the state, and none of those cases were tracked to those businesses. And the attorney is Jimmy Faircloth, who used to be a counsel to Governor Jindal. He says this, that the coronavirus restrictions may have been warranted the benefit of the doubt in the early days of the outbreak of the disease caused by the virus. But he says now there's more scientific data available and argues that the public has become well-versed in the art of social distancing and businesses have learned to alter their environments to accommodate this practice. Simply put, although perhaps justified a few months ago, it is no longer sufficient to rely on the hysteria, hearsay, and biased commentary as a basis to impose overly broad, draconian restrictions on fundamental rights.
Hmm.
So that was his argument.
And that's different than the lawsuit you were telling me that got filed in Denham Springs.
They had a lawsuit filed by a couple of businesses in Jefferson Parish that was filed in East Baton Rouge Parish against the governor.
Who was the one that you were telling me this morning?
That is not a lawsuit. They had Firehouse Barbecue in Denham Springs was closed down because they allowed...
Masks or no masks.
Well, they allowed customers to make the choice as to whether to wear a mask or not.
But I thought you didn't have to wear it if you had some kind of health issue and HIPAA prohibited them from asking.
Well, under the fiat of the governor, he apparently has a different view. So those are going to work its way through the court system. Now, hopefully, the best-case scenario is this becomes a moot issue.
Right.
By the time it works its way and this is cleared up.
Well, by the time those come to fruition and those cases get to the court, the courts, it'll be after November.
I think what they'll do, what they may do is ask for injunctive relief, or they have, because
to see how the Middle District especially on a TRO.
Well, one of the things people do, and lawyers don't like to admit it, but they do forum shop. Mm-hmm. What they do in these type of issues, you see them all over the nation. If you have one certain type of issue, they'll if you got maybe an issue involving certain type of issues, maybe left-leaning issues, you're going to see those suits filed in California, and left-leaning.
They picked a good district to file this.
Left-leaning districts, and sometimes in more conservative type of lawsuits like this one, they'll pick maybe conservative jurisdictions to work itself up. It's like picking your football stadium. You're picking your home team.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demarest, Cinceri, All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demmer, Cinceri, all things legal. You can also call us at our law firm in South Shore at 504-837-1304, 504-837-1304, and on the North Shore.
985-624-9697.
So that's the number. If you're in God's country.
You're in God's country. I'm going to come on our beautiful side of the lake.
Yes, yes. One interesting fact I read today, you know, a lot of issues have been regarding landlords and tenants because there have been a prohibition on evictions
right.
during this COVID crisis or pandemic.
When did the eviction deadline lift?
August 5th.
Yeah,
But they have, you know, before, if you had a federally backed loan, you could not proceed on the eviction.
Right.
And in some courts, you had to prove you didn't have a loan, which was, you know, you're proving a negative.
Yeah, you are proving a negative.
But one article I read was that there was $21 billion in unpaid or back or non-payment of rent
wow.
throughout the United States.
That's
so
a
that's
lot.
Just one of the,
yeah.
in, I guess, the consequences. Somebody is asking us, well, how's – you know, how, as far as your business is concerned, how, you know, how has it changed? I said, it's like taking a snow globe
and
shaking
it
all up and everything's just sort of.
But you know what's interesting? I was on a Zoom conference the other day with an attorney who actually lives down the street from us. And he was talking, and I think we can all attest, he's never been crazy or busy. And I think it's because everything got pushed till July for us for hearings. And so July and August have just been just back-to-back hearings.
Well, when you it's like a traffic jam.
Yeah.
It's basically using the courts are already full.
Mm-hmm.
And, we tell people, like in domestic cases, like if you go for certain rule days, you might have, for appeals or reviews, you might have 20 or 30 cases on the docket that day.
Right.
And, you know, what the judges do to a certain extent is a lot of these cases, they let you sit in the hallway.
Yeah, the traffic cops.
Talk about it because, you know, a lot of times when you're sitting in the hallway and you're paying attorney's fees, you come to resolutions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an unintended consequence
right.
of having such a full docket. But that's one of the that's just the reality of it. And it's now you have this traffic jam
right.
of cases. If you had, you know, whatever type of, you know, domestic issue, it just got backlogged and it's just starting to work through the backlog.
And you know what I'm wondering, because I've had a conversation with some attorneys and I heard somebody in court, I was actually in court on Friday, and the personnel was like, we really love Zoom, we wanted to continue. And there are unintended consequences of Zoom too, especially for young lawyers. That's how we learned. We would sit in court on rule day, we would watch the older attorneys, we'd listen to arguments. It's still how I liked, you know, that I like going to court to watch that. And so these younger attorneys, if we continue in Zoom for rule days, how are they going to learn?
Right. Well, that's, yeah. As Yogi Berra used to say, you can see a lot by observing.
By observing. You
who
can.
Is the greatest philosopher in American history.
According to Doug Cinceri.
He was. If you had a fork in the road, take it.
Take it.
Nobody right. goes there anymore because it's always too crowded. It ain't over till it's over. It gets late, early out there in center field. He's just a wonderful, wonderful, great philosopher. He's probably the greatest philosopher in 2,000 years. That's how big he is.
That's how big he is.
That's big.
I won't argue with you.
Now, for you plurimillennials, Yogi Berra is not a cartoon character.
No,
he was the catcher for the New York Yankees and great philosopher. All right, got to educate them,
there you
know, because they don't teach history in the schools today.
I know.
All right, we're going to our CBS News update, and then we're going to go to local news, and we'll be back in about 10 minutes for hour number two in all things legal, so stay tuned. Hey, we're back for hour number two. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demmer, Cinceri, all things legal. Give us a call at 260-1870, and we're on till 10 o'clock. We were talking about the Saints' first preseason game. August 2nd, 1967, which was 53 years ago. And one of the things, well, the Saints were actually 5-1 that preseason. They won their next five games.
Really?
Yeah. They had a veteran team. So that's why they, they thought they were going to.
Who was the quarterback back then?
funny you should ask that.
I wasn't even prompted. This is a total...
I'm going to ask Bill Becknell to confirm this with me if he's listening. But I think they traded their number one pick for Gary Quazzo, who was the backup quarterback to Baltimore Colts. He played behind Johnny Unitas. And he was supposed to be their starter, but then Billy Kilmer came in from the 49ers, and he ended up beating them out at some point during the season. And Gary Quazzo is now a dentist. So he was the starting quarterback, and it was interesting. They had six preseason games. Now here's the legal issue I wanted to lead into. It's not a legal issue.
All right.
In 1969, in preseason, the Saints went from their gold helmets to the black helmets. I'm sure you don't remember that, huh?
Okay.
So they went to the black helmets.
Okay.
And so, as the story was told by Bill Becknell, and is that John Meekum just decided, I wanted to do the black helmets. And he said, we're going to wear black helmets. But he did not get approval from league office to do that. And they didn't have all the licensing in place. So they played six preseason games with black helmets, and the league made them go back to the gold helmets because they didn't have the licensing.
Why would they care?
Well, licensing is big.
I know licensing is big, but why?
Because, you know, copyrights, trademarks, and, you know, before they want to trademark and legally protect all that before they put it out there.
Gotcha.
So licensing is big. When we had the collective bargaining agreement where we had the strike in 87, 88, right. 89, 90, a big part of the issue was licensing revenues because it wasn't that important before.
Well, that's what I'm wondering back then. What was the deal about black helmets?
You still had some licensing, but you had to get approval from the NFL first before you changed.
Gotcha.
And John was 30 years old at the time, 29 years old. He's sort of a young guy involved. Mm-hmm. I like black helmets. Let's do it.
Yeah.
And
I own the team.
He owns the team. So there you go. But so that was sort of interesting as far as that's concerned. And before we – one last sports, and we'll go to law is LSU's going to play a 10-game SEC schedule. Now, with all the coronavirus stuff and everything being canceled –
is it because you can't get corona with SEC games?
I don't know. I think they're going to play less games, so I think they wanted to make it more meaningful.
Gotcha. Well, that makes sense.
And I love the all SEC schedule.
Sure.
I mean, that was.
Is it going to be a harder schedule?
Oh yeah.
That's what I
figured. I mean, SEC's.
I know. That's what I'm figuring. I'm figuring the other ones gave them a little bit of a break.
Now it's too bad for Nicholls State and Coach Rebo. I love Coach Rebo. Wonderful job at Nicholls State. He's not going to be able to play at Tiger Stadium. UT San Antonio is not going to play. We missed the Texas game also. And I think I forgot the other game that we're going to lose. But all 10 games will be very meaningful. Because when you go to a game like, you know, when they play, you know, Northwestern or.
So let me ask you this. With the whole ticket issue and only 50%, so the away or the guest team won't be able to bring their fans?
I don't know. Probably not. Very limited. LSU band is not traveling to away games.
So are we going to get an email that says, hey, listen, two of your four tickets are not good this
year? Yeah,
we could.
Hmm. We could. Hmm. So we'll just have to watch at home if that happens.
Yeah, you can come to and you don't have to wear a mask.
We don't have to wear a mask if we watch it here.
No. You know, the only thing I'll miss is the fountain drinks, but we'll listen.
The fountain drink? The cups. We ran out of the cups.
We did run out of the cups.
Somebody took our LSU cups.
I know. I think it was the construction guys in the
back. Well, we'll have to. We'll go to one game and get. I'll buy a bunch of Cokes and restock my LSU cups.
You know
what I want to talk about a little bit is Justin always calls about trust in the States.
He's a nice guy.
Great guy. His father. I've talked about his father, Jack Martell. I didn't know he went to Notre Dame though.
I didn't either.
A lot of people from back in Jack Marcel's time from Louisiana went to Notre Dame because
it was Catholic.
It was Catholic, and you got a higher, you spent less time in purgatory if you went to Notre Dame.
But wasn't it above the Mason-Dixon line?
Huh?
Isn't it above the Mason-Dixon line?
No, but it's like the Vatican. It's like it's like the Vatican in the United States.
Yeah, because my dad said you could go anywhere you want, but it has to go be below the Mason-Dixon line.
But he probably didn't. He probably forgot about Notre Dame. But Notre Dame is like, you know, it's like a branch office of the Vatican. So it used to be, you know, it used to be a and so they, so a lot of people from New Orleans used to go to, or a disproportionate number of people from New Orleans because that was, they were told to do that since, you know, if you were going to St. Anthony, they say you got to go to Notre Dame if you want to be sanctified or super sanctified, less time in purgatory. So, and plus they had touchdown Jesus.
There you go.
I mean, if you love football, I mean, you got the best supporter you ever there. You got, you know,
touchdown
got them overlooking
Jesus.
You. Huh? There is.
I know.
You saw him?
I saw him. I've seen him.
You've seen him. It's a it's beautiful.
It is
it's
beautiful.
Beautiful.
It is beautiful.
But anyway, how do we get? We're talking about estates and
somehow
trust.
We got into
We digress. But, you know, we always talk about trust. And trust is just basically a container to keep your stuff.
With the directions
with directions on how to take it out. But one of the things you can do is a lot of people, you know, the generation before us were big savers.
Right.
And a lot of time, their biggest asset they have in their estate are IRAs, right?
Yep.
And there's, you know, a lot of times if they have concerns maybe about their children being able to handle a lot of money in an IRA, you could even put the IRA beneficiary in a trust
right.
to make sure that the money spreads out over the life of, you know, over a period of time rather than giving the beneficiary who may be a little irresponsible with money, pulling it all out at once, having a big tax liability and spending it all.
Right.
So one of the things you can do, you know, even an IRA trust.
But what a lot of people don't understand is those IRAs are not governed by your will. So
no,
they'll put.
That's
they'll
right.
think, "Oh, I'm going to do a testamentary trust, which is a trust inside of your will," and they name the beneficiary on their IRA beneficiary form as my testamentary trust. And unfortunately, some financial people think that that's an appropriate way, and it's just really not.
Right.
And it's just. I mean,
so
you can't.
So if you have a large IRA trust. Oh, IRA, and you're concerned about your one of your children getting getting access to it in a short period of time, you could put it inside of a trust for someone else basically to manage.
Right, but it has to be a living trust. It has to be a trust in existence
now. It can't be
in
your will. Now, one of the things we talk about is your if you have an IRA, the beneficiary is directed by the beneficiary designation form and not the will.
Correct.
And so, you know, the only time it would be directed by the will is if you don't have a beneficiary listed or the beneficiary is listed as the estate.
Right.
But IRA trust, and also, too, if you have an IRA and you have a special needs child, you could have an IRA special needs trust.
Right.
So that that adult child who has a special need can benefit by use by the could benefit by the proceeds from the IRA without affecting their
benefits.
Their government services.
Yeah, and we do a lot of, I've just found we've been doing many more special needs trusts in the last couple of years than in the past.
Yeah. Now, just again, with a special, they call it supplemental needs trust.
It's,
which is better, also known as AKA, that's a special needs trust. And the special needs trust basically is a lot of, if you have a adult child who has a challenge or a disability, and they're on SSI, they're on Medicaid, or other government services, what would happen is if they receive an inheritance, they would be knocked off of those government services until basically they spent the inheritance. I mean, the technical rules are if you have more than $2,000 of liquid assets, you're no longer eligible.
And then you get knocked off, you have to get back
in
line.
Because, I mean, there was a situation where you had a beneficiary who was receiving government services. She needed 24/7 care. She had a very, very serious condition. And she inherited a modest amount of money, $10,000. And it was and when that occurred, she was taken off of government services. She no longer had her attendance. She no longer had medical coverage. They then the government required her to show that she had spent the $10,000.
Which probably went in a blink of an eye with 24/7 care.
Right. And then they had to get back in line for government services. It took them a couple of years to get,
it's a sad situation.
And that could have been avoided if in the planning process the money was allocated to a special needs trust, and basically a special or supplemental needs trust. And what that allows is for the benefit, we're being overly simplistic, but for the beneficiary to benefit from the contribution or the trust without losing their government services.
Right.
Now, there's special language that needs to be in there. They can't be, the beneficiary can't be in charge of the money. It could be used for most everything, but a few.
And the biggest thing is it's a first-party trust, so it goes back to the, so upon the death of the beneficiary, if there's any money left in it, the government gets to, it depends what kind of money's going in.
If it comes from someone else, you don't have to give it back to the government. So that's, one of the things that's becoming more and more common. It's very interesting also, too, and this is very unofficial, but parents, adult parents who have special needs children, they seem to live longer.
Well, yeah, because they have something to live for, and it's to take care of those, their children.
They're saying nobody will take care of my children
like I will.
So I got to hang around here and take care of them. Right. All right, I hear the music. Let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demarest Cinceri, All Things Legal. A little Beatles bumper music there.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demarest Cinceri, All Things Legal. Let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Lance. Hey, Lance, you on All Things Legal. What can we do for you?
How's it going?
Good.
Hey, Lance.
What do you have, Lance?
So I had a question. I'm single. I live by myself, and I live out in Kenner. I have two cars, one that I obviously drive every day. And then when I bought my new car, I kept my old car because it wasn't worth the price that I could get for it to sell it. But it was worth it for me to keep it to have peace of mind in case my car breaks down or somebody hits my car and totals it or anything like that. Well, somebody in my neighborhood started calling code enforcement because I hadn't moved my car in a while. But it was a running car. Now, code enforcement came out this week and took my car. I was wondering if there was any kind of legal recourse to get my car back.
Who was your code inspector? Do you know who it is? Do you know his
name? No, because I've never met him. I got to work every day. I do construction, so I haven't stopped working.
You know what I would do? Kenner's great. I've worked with code enforcement in Kenner on a lot of different issues, and they are very flexible if you give them good input. What I would do is call code enforcement right now, find out who's the code enforcement official who actually took the car. I'm sure they gave you warning, though. And why don't you explain that to him? Show him that you have insurance in place. Tell him it's just simply a second car that runs. And explain that to them. And I think they would work with you. I think there was the assumption that it was an abandoned car that didn't, that was not, that was just left there. So I would suspect if you called them up, and I, in fact, I know a few of them, and they are very, very thoughtful. They're willing to work with you. And a lot of times if you give them information that is helpful as to them understanding what's really going on, they'll work with you. So I'd call code enforcement.
Okay.
And
out of instance, like say they don't want to, they're just like, it's gone.
Plan B? Find out who's your councilman on the Kenner City Council and call them.
Look,
I'm telling you, they do a very, very good job. I don't know what part of Kenner you're in, but that's what the council people are there for. And
I'm right on the border of Kenner Metairie, so.
Okay, so I'm not sure who that is, but call them up and explain to them the situation because they have a lot of input as to, a lot of times they field complaints from neighborhoods about certain code violations, and they say, I received this complaint, and they'll tell code enforcement, and they'll go out and take a look at it. Now, I suspect they gave you some type of note, may not have given you some type of note.
I thought they had to post it on the car for so many days.
Yeah.
It was a red sticker or something.
they put a warning on it. They claim they put one back, I don't know, in June. Never saw it. And they put one on there last Friday. Now, so I saw the one last Friday because I went to go take it off. And I don't know if you've ever seen the stickers, but they don't just come off. So the first one, I've never seen it. I don't know what happened to it. I don't know if they didn't stick it on there properly. But the second one, I had to go get a knife, like a razor blade, and scrape it off.
Well,
and when they put it on there, there's no number to call or anything. It's just a sticker that says, hey, your thing's been classified as an abandoned vehicle. And I'm like, okay, well, I didn't know who to call. And,
call code. Start with code enforcement, number one. If that doesn't work, go to Kenner City Council. If that doesn't work, call the mayor's office. I mean, that's what they're there for. Now, be polite. Be respectful.
Yeah,
be persistent.
I try to be.
It's a mistake. Just say it's a mistake. I have two cars. It's not abandoned. In fact, it's drivable, and I just keep it there. And ask them in the future, say, well, in the future, what would you like me to do to avoid the situation? Maybe they'll have a suggestion as far as parking or something to that effect. But, that's what I would do. We've had some, some difficult code issues with Kenner in the past. We work things out. And one thing Kenner wants to do, and they're very, very, they've been on sort of a kicker doing this the last 6-7 years, is to make Kenner, beautification of Kenner, or, make it family friendly. So they don't like a lot of abandoned houses. They don't put up with that. They don't like a lot of nuisances. They don't like neighbors who aren't being respectful to the other neighbors. They're very vigilant about that, but in a very good way. And so, just explain to them. But when we've had situations where we had to work things out, if you work with them, they've been very, very helpful, very, very responsive. I would do that. Now, I'm not saying you won't have to be persistent. Okay, because anytime you're dealing with government, you have to be persistent. But code enforcement, your council person, and then the mayor's office, and I'm sure you'll find some type of relief. Okay?
Okay.
All right, my man. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go to phone lines. Let's go to Jeffrey. Hey, Jeff, you're on All Things Legal. Jerry, sorry,
hey.
Jerry.
That's okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question this morning is pertaining to a realtor hired by a homeowner to lease their house. And in the process of doing so, the homeowner requires or requests to not have any pets in their house. Mm-hmm. If the realtor is approached by a potential client and states they have a service animal, what legal rights does the homeowner have to refuse, or can they refuse? And what does the realtor have to be careful of refusing, possibly being sued?
That is a great question. And I'm going to say that, there's laws, the Fair Housing Act.
Right.
And there's certain laws for renters. And I'm going to give you my phone number, 837-1304. I will check that out because I'm not sure now. Typically, if you just have pets, you have the right to say there's no pets. But there's a relationship between service animals.
That's correct.
And the owner, that it could be an infringement on some type of disability. Now, with the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that's something that is very, very interesting and a brilliant question. I would say that here are the two competing factors. Is one, the landlord's right to maintain the premises in a way that he sees suitable versus infringing on the rights of someone who has a disability. And maybe under the Fair Housing Act or under some type of Americans with Disabilities Act provision, one of those type provisions. And Michelle's doing some quick research right now.
I am.
Now
I'm on Westlaw right now. It says under Louisiana Service Animal Act and Americans with Disability Act, people with disabilities may bring service dogs into all public accommodations.
Now for public accommodations, now we don't know.
No, and I don't know if that applies to rent. I don't know if that applies to rental, but we will figure it out. And
What
is the number again?
504-837-1304. We'll get our crack researcher Amanda on that.
Yeah, we'll get her to take a look at it.
Yeah, I think that my instinct says it is something you have to look into and be very careful if you're a realtor. And you would have to tailor you'd have to tailor your presentation of what's for lease around those particular laws. And that, you know, that's a very, very sticky issue.
Especially now. And then the question is, are they true service dogs? Are they emotional support dogs? And then where's the difference?
That was going to be my next question. Does this person or persons have to carry some sort of identification or a document stating that is truly a service animal, and for what service?
Well, what I just read is if you're going into a public area, they cannot ask you. It's kind of like a HIPAA violation.
But they can't ask you, but it's, I would think whoever a realtor is in this position is, you get the legal opinion and you formulate your presentation around the legal opinion. And I get it, pets are very, they diminish the value of rental property. I mean, they're very, and I guess taking it a step further, I guess you could put certain rules in there as far as the pet and maintenance and cleanliness. What I would suspect, if you did have pets, you could probably push to some certain extent regarding cleaning. Maintenance. Now, if you make it too onerous, they might say, well, that's just a pretext for not having service animals here. But I think that's a...
Yeah, what I read just a little bit, and we can get a more definite answer for you, is that it has to be proof that the dog is because of a disability, not because of an emotional support. Does it make sense? So
I'm glad you stated that, because I've come across that specific entity quite often. There's a difference between a physical disability and an emotional disability, and which one, supersedes the other, I guess.
Yeah,
What I've read is that to get the service dog based upon a disability, there has to be a medical provider giving you a statement that you're in need of what your disability is. So I don't think you're going to get that from an emotional support dog, but I think if you're like an epileptic or whatever, the different areas they do have these service dogs. It's an interesting question, though.
COVID-19 can make you an emotional person and a service animal for that.
Yeah.
And you got both sides. You got the service dogs that are, need to be there, and then you got Fifi.
Yeah, I was about to see the little yapping chihuahua.
The little poodle,
that you're carrying around.
Whom Miss Elsie's carrying in the first class in the airplane, So.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks, Jerry.
That's a brilliant question.
That was a good question.
You stumped us.
I'm going to find the answer. Because I don't like to not know the answer.
Okay, let's go to a break. Doug Sinceri, Michelle Kemmerer, Sinceri, All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief time out. Hey, we're back. Doug Sinceri, Michelle Kemmerer, Sinceri. Okay, got a couple of texts before we go to Mickey. Vince said, go Cavs.
There you go.
What a great De La Salle family we are. Oh, yes. That's the best. De La Salle's great.
I know.
Great Thank
school.
You, Mr. Altabello. Thank you, Mr. Stabler. Thank you, all those wonderful Christian brothers. And it says, it also says, Vince says, you make a very nice appearance.
You?
No, you.
Oh.
Not me.
Thanks, Vince.
I mean, which is great, because now we social distance. Because when Albert does the show, he does it from his home.
Right.
Which is, when I used to see him in a studio,
I'd pick him up
at 7:30, but he usually just came in from the night before at about 7. So he'd be out the limousine, clean himself up, and I'd pick him up and go to studio. So he was a little rough in the studio. Sometimes it wasn't so easy on the eyes, But yeah, I agree. You're a lot easier in the eyes than Albert.
Thank you. That's
probably the understatement of the year.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It says a lot.
All right, let's go to Mickey's. We got a question regarding a tree. We hadn't had a tree question in nearly a week. All right, let's go, Mickey. What you got?
Doug, I live behind Chappelle.
Yes.
And person got a big oak tree, and now the limbs are, you can't even drive a car on it. Pretty much you can't drive a car, my truck. You know, whose responsibility is it to trim the tree on a person's property?
Well, you got to, first thing you have to do is to get an arborist to figure out how to, if however you're going to trim the tree, is it going to be in a way that affects the integrity of the of the tree? So one of the things that you have to be careful of is if you're going to trim the tree and it's substantial, you have to do it in a way that doesn't affect the general integrity of the tree.
What the question I'm asking is, who's responsible to trim that tree? The parish or the homeowners?
Oh no, not the parish. The homeowners.
Where is the tree totally on? Is any part of the tree on your property? Is on their?
No. It's, you know, when I turn down the street, the tree's hanging way over, and my truck is barely making an aged tree. But it's on the homeowner's property.
I would say as far as it would be your responsibility.
Yeah, I think it's his responsibility, but he's got to make sure he does it right, that he doesn't affect the tree that's...
Right. Yeah, it would be basically your responsibility to trim the tree, but you'd have to just do it in a way that doesn't affect the integrity of it.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Did Bill grow up in Indian Village?
Bill Becknell?
No.
Bill.
Your law partner.
Albert?
Yeah.
No, Albert grew up in near Holy Rosary, and then he moved to Covington. Now, there's a lot of Nikos.
There's a lot of them.
The Nikos were a very fertile tribe there.
Yeah, I know.
So you can't go.
But it's the homeowner's responsibility to trim that tree.
Yes. But you
okay.
Just,
all right. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Y'all
so
be safe.
Thank
all
you.
Right, we will. Let's go to David. Got a question regarding payments. Hey, David, you're on All Things Legal.
Hey, guys, good morning. I'm so glad I came across your show. I have a very complicated situation, but hopefully you can just give me some advice. So my son, 5 months ago, started working for a very large hardware store. He's in college currently. And when he first got hired, they told him that they don't cut checks anymore. So the option was either you give them information on a checking or a savings account, or what they do is they give you a preloaded debit card, and that's how payment is issued. Well, he's got a checking and savings account, but he didn't give them the information in time, and they wound up issuing this debit card situation. Mm-hmm. So he's been using this card for 5 months. Mm-hmm. About 2.5 weeks ago, he went to use his debit card, and it's unavailable. So he called the company. It's a third-party company. Come to find out, they froze the account because they say that they need address verification. Mm-hmm. Now, the situation he's got is he's in college. He's living in an apartment currently in Lafayette. And so what they asked him to do was to provide either a, you know, an electricity bill, water bill, phone bill, things like that. It's the apartment's name. I told him to go down to the apartment complex, have them fax over something to the company, which he did. Now, they told him that after, it's a long and involved story, trust me, but eventually I got involved with him with the situation. It's been 2.5 weeks ago. He's provided the information immediately. They gave him no prior warning that they were going to need this information. They freeze his account, which means that, you know, this is money he legally owned for work, you know, that he had done for this company. A very large company is significant for a college student. I mean, it's in the neighborhood of $600 that they've frozen up. They still have it frozen up. Again, he faxed the information over to this company over 2 weeks ago. Go ahead. Yes.
What I advise is I'd have him work that out between his employer and the third party administrator. I mean, The employer has a duty to get a person to pay his wages. And if he doesn't do that, there's really some substantial statutes that There's it's this.
But it sounds like he was paid. So the employer paid the third party.
But he was paid.
Correct.
But the third party administrator is an agent of the employer.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
So therefore, if the third party administrator doesn't get it right, the employer is ultimately responsible for it. So I would go back to the employer and say, look.
Contact the HR department.
Say, look, I haven't been paid. It's an issue between you and your third-party administrator. You get it straight. It's not my deal. I've done everything I was supposed to for the third-party administrator. They froze the account. They didn't do this. They didn't do that. Either okay. A, I'm making demand on you to do this. And number two, let me know what I need to do if there's anything else that I haven't done to receive payment, but you have a duty to pay me timely, and that could be a wage violation on the employer. Now, again, if you're going to write these letters to your employer saying you violated the fair labor standards or something like that, you know, they're not going to be very happy with you.
I would make sure too, for your son's sake. Because a lot of these kids that, you know, don't text it, do it in an email, call them, and then send an email confirming it so you have written proof, don't it, if any, there has to be any further action.
Well, and I'll tell you what I've done is I've actually sent letters. It's a very complicated situation, but the third-party company is a subsidiary of another company. So I've sent letters both to the third-party company, their parent company, as well as his employer. I've sent letters to state senators, state representatives, U.S. senators, U.S. representatives, and I've yet to hear from any of them except for one who basically said that there's nothing that they can do. We just have to work through the system. And again, it's been 2.5 weeks now.
Now, if he's not going to work for them anymore.
He's employed with them.
Yeah, I know. I would say if he wasn't.
So are they still putting his wages that he's earning today on that debit card?
No, he has since rectified that. Okay, However, he has yet to see any of his payments deposited into his checking account yet.
Right. Gotcha.
Yeah, so I would sort of bring it to the attention of the employer and let them know the ball's in their court to fix the situation.
Just final question. Does this third-party company have a legal right to withhold these funds without prior warning? I mean, they've given him no warning by letter, by phone, by text, by email, nothing whatsoever. And they just, at will, decide to put a freeze on this account because they needed an address verification.
I will say this. There's so much fraud that occurs with banks, financial institutions, third-party payroll, that they go over the top trying to protect themselves.
And there could have been something that was sent to him that you don't know about that had that small print.
Yeah, so... But they do. They're often over the top, and they're often so cautious that it just impairs the entire process. But thanks for the call. Call us at 837-1304, 837-1304, at North Shore
985-624-9697.
If you have any further questions, gotta go to break. Doug Censeri, Michelle Demers, Censeri, All Things Legal. We'll be right back.
Team claim.
Huh?
I have a lot of consortium getting my things.
Yeah. Well. Hey, we're back. We're about 3-4 minutes. Doug Censeri, Michelle Demers, Censeri, All Things Legal. Nico and Censeri, we make the complex understandable.
That's right.
That's what they taught us at De La Salle. Make the complex understandable. See, if you went to maybe other school, you make the complex even more complex.
I have a Dominican education.
I'm just kidding with you. We have rivals. You know, the Catholic League used to have big rivals.
I know. You know, if he was alive... You all would just be going toe-to-toe.
Because he went to Jesuit.
He went to Jesuit.
We used to get holidays at De La Salle if we beat Jesuit. We did. They'd give us a holiday.
I think there was a rival in my dad's own family because they had four boys. Three went to Jesuit and one went to De La Salle.
Right. We were a De La Salle family.
I know. My grandmother worked in the De La Salle cafeteria.
Yeah. She turned out great.
She did turn out great.
Because she worked at De La Salle.
There you go.
No, people don't understand that. But it was like a big rival. But now it's not. Everybody loves everybody. You know.
I don't even think you can say it because now De La Salle's a girl school too.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
Jesuits always.
Jesuits. I give Jesuits a hard time. Because I went to De La Salle. But that was a big deal when we beat Jesuits.
Jesuits a great school.
Even though Jesuits won't play De La Salle in sports anymore now. They won't.
They won't?
No, they're scared of us.
Oh, huh.
They're scared of us.
That's interesting.
We're going to get back in that Catholic League there.
So when did they get out of the Catholic League?
Oh, about 15 years ago, 20 years ago.
So they're in, like, the public school league or something? Or
no, they're in a lower classification.
Ah, gotcha.
They're lower, but they're doing good. All right. I asked Bill Becknell. We're talking about the first Saints preseason game, Bill, Texas. I said, who was the first starting quarterback for the first preseason game? I guess right. It was Gary Quazzo. But Billy Kilmer threw a touchdown pass to Les Kelly for the only score where they score 7 points. Les Kelly was, I think, a linebacker out of Alabama that was converted to fullback, if I remember correctly.
Bill should have called. That would have been a great
one. I know. I knew Bill would be listening.
It's hard when we're not in the studio, so you really can't.
Yeah. So, but I texted him. He was there. I mean,
I knew, you said last night he would. He was there. I know he was.
He was there. He was working the sidelines for that first game. They played Anaheim. And you could see a little snippet on YouTube of the first game on if you put in Saints preseason Los Angeles Rams. Huh. Now, he's texting me something else about the game because I knew he would know.
I know
that he did that. So Quazzo was brought in as the starting quarterback, and I'm waiting to see what else he's going to say. But he better do it quick because I only got about 2 minutes left. But actually, they had training camp in San Diego. And he said it was a beautiful scene because it overlooked like a bluff, I think he was explaining it, and I think it was an ocean. And he said that the first training camp was in San Diego. Tom Fierce was the coach. And, you know, they were actually a very good team veteran-wise. They were players that were sort of past their peak.
There you go.
He said, okay. Billy said he talked to Billy Kilmer this morning, and I'll have to have Billy call into our show. You know what I did? I'll tell you this. One of my first weeks at working for Bill, he said, I'm busy. I need you to entertain and take Billy Kilmer out to lunch because it was his first year at the Saints Hall of Fame. And I'm like, I get paid for this. So I took off.
You're like a kid in a candy
store. Yeah, I was all ears. I was all ears. So we'll have Billy Kilmer call in. I'd love to talk to him again. He was a great guy. He's old school, too. Yeah. I love those old school players. And you know what? He stood up during the national anthem when
there
he played.
Go.
So I even like him better there. All right. We're about out of here. So that's
thanks for having me today.
Yeah, thanks for responding to my elbow.
Sure,
this morning.
I just had to walk down the hall.
You
walked
right across the hall.
Right across
make
the
it
hall.
Here. So we'll be back next week on All Things Legal. So everybody be good, be blessed, and stay cool. See you next week.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.